Welcome to the local news roundup on The Point here on WCAI. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran, and with me in the Woods Hole studio is Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Hello, Cindy.
Good morning.
And thanks for coming in. Sam Houghton is here from the Mashpee Enterprise as well.
Hi, Sam. Good morning,
Sean. Good morning. We'll be speaking with several other local journalists about what's in the news this week. Let's see. Sarah Brown will join us from the Vineyard Gazette. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Jim Deruda of the New Bedford Standard Times. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. And we'll also speak with Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Lots to talk about. Cindy McCormick, let's talk about the water contaminants that Barnstable has been dealing with. They have a plan. I know there was a meeting last night. We're not sure exactly what the result of that was. We'll try to find that. But they were considering spending millions of dollars on this carbon treatment plant to try to take care of that groundwater contamination.
Yeah, this contaminant problem is going into the millions of dollars. And what they were considering last night was whether to appropriate $6.5 million, and that's for the carbon treatment system, for the Maher Wellfield on Old Yarmouth Road. And that would be a year-round structure to treat three wells. And that's because the contaminants, they're called contaminants of emerging concern, were found in the well. There are toxic perfluorinated chemicals. That's the type that's commonly found in firefighting foams. The money would also be used for pilot testing for another type of solvent used in the manufacture of chemicals, and that is also found in the wells.
Hmm. Now, go ahead.
Now, if the funding is approved, that would bring the amount allocated for cleanup, since chemicals were found in the water supply that was found in 2015. That would bring the total at this point in time to more than $11 million.
Wow. And they're still trying to sort out exactly, we're talking about three wells, they're trying to sort out exactly where that contamination came from, right?
Yeah, there is a lawsuit already from the town against Barnstable County, but these wells are not yet part of that lawsuit. The Maher wells are not part of the lawsuit yet, because the lawsuit contends that chemicals entered wells serving Hyannis after firefighting foams used by the Barnstable County Fire and Rescue Training Academy got soaked into the ground. Uh-huh. Testing is being done right now to see if the contamination in the Maher wells is from the academy or possibly from Barnstable Municipal Airport. The assistant attorney for the town of Barnstable, Charles McLaughlin, says they'll know in like 3 to 4 months because they're studying the issue. But he did say, we don't think the airport contributed.
Hmm. So when this first came to light, Barnstable went to its neighbor, Yarmouth, and said, can we hook up for some water so that they could, you know, continue to meet demand, particularly in the summer when the demand goes up.
Yeah, and this interconnect is still in place. They're interconnected with the Yarmouth water system. For that cost is about $1.25 million a year. And you probably recall, there was a health advisory warning at first for women, for pregnant women, nursing mothers, and children not to drink the water in Hyannis. And that was in effect from late May until early July of 2016. And the town made bottled water available at that time.
But that's not going on now.
Well, they're interconnected with the Yarmouth system,
right.
so that's okay. Contributing the water that is not a problem to so it's considered healthy to drink right now. And the problem with perfluorinated chemicals is that they're linked to a variety of problems, thyroid problems, some types of cancers, and even effects on fetal development. So it's considered not a very good thing to have in your drinking water.
Okay. We're going to continue to follow that story, of course. Let's bring Sam Houghton into the conversation now as we talk about this real tragedy in Mashpee. I know both the Times and the Falmouth and Mashpee Enterprise papers have covered this. A toddler, 14 months old, struck by a vehicle in Mashpee. Sam, you want to lay this out for us?
Yeah. It's obviously a tragic event here. Police, you know, I've still relayed little details what happened, but we do know his name is Camden Hendricks. His family called him Camo, according to his obituary. Right, he's 14 months old. What we do know is he was struck by a pickup truck. I guess it was driven by an acquaintance of the family near their home in Coombs Lane in Mashpee. Police are saying no charges have been filed yet. This took place Friday last week around 5 p.m. We understand that the fire department responded and brought Camden to the hospital, where he later would die. And he is a member of the Wampanoag tribe. And on Wednesday, they held a funeral for him at the Old Indian Cemetery. It was a very large showing of support there from the tribe. We heard from a number of tribal members about Camden. So, yeah, not a great story here.
No, it's awful, awful. Any additional details the Times was able to pick up?
Well, just that the Cape Cod Regional Crash Reconstruction Team is working with the Cape and Islands DA's office and the Mashpee Police on the investigation. They're trying to figure out exactly what happened to this child. And the accident was on, you know, Coombs Lane, that's a dead end dirt road.
Yeah, just a little road there. Right, that's right off of what, Great House?
I think Old Barnesville, I believe. I'm not 100% sure on that, but.
Oh, very sad for the family and for the tribe. And I understand the chairman of the tribe was saying we're going to surround this family with love now, which is, I'm sure, something they need.
Yeah.
Sam Houghton from the Mashpee Enterprise. Let's talk about the tech school. So Mashpee is part of what, Upper Cape Tech?
No, the Cape Cod Tech down in Harwich.
That's what I never understood. Why Harwich when Mashpee's? Maybe you don't have the answer.
Yeah, that happened a while ago before I was on board. But right, the selectmen had proposed withdrawing from the district. I think the reasons they think they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place here, where you know the tech school is looking at building a $140 million building. They're also selectmen were saying one of the more expensive tech schools in the state. I think they're the third highest. So they had considered this article for town meeting that would allow them to, I guess, seek the state legislature and allowing them to withdraw from the district. And what we had on Monday was parents, teachers, students, and you know, graduates of the school actually flood the selectmen's meeting, just a regular meeting beforehand. And you know, really spoke highly of the school, you know, saying it provided options for students that might not necessarily fit the mold of a public school. Also that, you know, really, you know, helps the local working class here on the Cape and the Islands.
Sure.
And, you know, the selectmen had, this was during the public comment period of their board meeting, so they didn't really, you know, respond.
Yeah.
Right. It did catch up to the chairman, and you know he's saying, look, this is not about a tech school. We're not against tech schools by any means. We think that's a valid option, but what we're saying here is that this is going to be really expensive, and a new building is going to cost them about $20 million for only 50 to 60 students. And at the same time, they're looking, we got news this week that the Quashnet School project, that's jumped from $8 million now to $11 million. And we're not even getting into wastewater. So the board is really looking at some high costs down the road, and they really want to, you know, send a message maybe to the tech school that, you know, this is expensive.
School buildings are expensive.
Yeah, right.
So if Mashpee withdraws from Cape Cod Tech, where would those students go?
That's a good question. I posed that to the chairman, and he's saying we're not to that process yet. This is just an article for the town meeting to say, you know, basically giving the selectmen the opportunity to reach out to the state legislature and say, you know, we want to withdraw.
And otherwise, if they didn't get that permission from the legislature, they would have to get permission from all the other towns to withdraw,
right,
who are already part of that school.
Right. And I did reach out to the Upper Cape Tech to see what it would take for them to join the Upper Cape Tech. He's saying that I believe it's five other district or towns within their district would have to allow them in, and they already have a waiting list. So, you know, it's an interesting topic, to say the least.
Certainly in the context of education and the importance of tech schools now here on the Cape, we don't even have a 4-year advanced college. So if you're getting just your high school education and you have the tech background, you can go right to work.
Right.
Right. Otherwise, you're graduating and your options are pretty limited unless you're continuing your education. Yeah. Okay, let's go to the phone where Sarah Brown is joining us from the Vineyard Gazette. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning, Sean. Hi.
Good morning. Nice to speak with you. I understand that there's some reporting in the Gazette this week about some longstanding fire safety issues in the Dukes County Courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a system activated to take care of this. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it's pretty pretty interesting. And yeah, they're really looking at this because, you know, the Edgartown Courthouse is the only courthouse on the island. It dates back to 1856. So they're understandably, you know, it's an old building, and it can be hard to keep those, you know, up to date as far as safety goes. But last week we reported that a fire inspection at the courthouse, I think at the end of December, turned up some serious problems, including a pretty old smoke detector system dating back to, I believe, the 1980s that might not work. The fire chief said this week he wasn't even sure that it's functional, and it's hard to test because you'd actually have to spray smoke into the detector.
Oh, my.
So they aren't even clear about that. And also some emergency exit doors that were impassable and some other things. So as kind of a stopgap measure after the inspection, a fire watch system was introduced, which is kind of the old system dating back to before smoke detectors and other alarms, where someone walks through the building, all three floors, every 15 minutes and checks all the rooms to make sure that there's no fire and kind of do a safety check. And the county emergency management director is doing that in the meantime, just as kind of the alternate to the alarm system. But the county owns the building and they rent it to the courthouse, most of it to the courthouse, the court system. And they've discussed the issue, I think, at least twice in the last few weeks. The county commission has approved $50,000 for new smoke alarms and detectors and some other repairs. But we also found out, it turns out this is not a new issue, that a 2001 report detailed a lot of these recommended upgrades, including the fire alarms, and the estimated cost at that time was about $13,000. So, you know, in the meantime, I think maybe, you know, the cost might have gone up in the last 16 years. So
I would say so.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sarah Brown. Paying attention to the Deuce County Courthouse and the fire concerns there. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
You're welcome. Cindy McCormick, a tragic story, a Barnstable County, a Barnstable High School teacher murdered in her home, and the suspect is her husband.
Yeah, that's the victim is Mary Molly Fratantonio. She was 35 years old and a special education teacher at Barnstable High, and she had been a preschool teacher in the past. And she was found dead about a little after 2 a.m. on Tuesday after the police received a flurry of 911 calls from multiple people. And when the police arrived, she and her husband lived at 89 Childbrook Road with two small children, and they found the husband, that's Christopher S. Fratantonio, outside the house, and state troopers told us that he confessed to killing his wife, giving officers a detailed description of why and how and where the knife could be found.
Don't have a lot of details. He was arraigned, plea entered, not guilty.
Yeah, he's a pretrial conference for March 27th. And, there's not a lot of details. The Cape and Islands DA, Michael O'Keefe, said, we're aware of some events that may have triggered the incident, but they're investigating. A neighbor woman whose son had Mary Fratantonio as a teacher called both in an eighth grade at the high school and in preschool, called her an amazingly kind woman. But she said the husband, who had a wood refloor refinishing business, was also nice, just seemed nice.
Yeah, I know the reporter from the Times went and spoke to a number of people who came by to visit the scene or who knew the couple or the husband, and most all of them said pretty positive things.
Yeah, yeah. One of the co-workers of the husband said that the couple did have some money problems, and that Christopher Fratantonio suffered from depression, had some anger management issues. And interestingly, he changed his last name from Melvin to his current last name, which I believe is his mother's maiden name, in 2005. We don't know why, but that took place before the couple was married.
Right. And of course, we don't know if those statements by that gentleman were 100% accurate or not. We'll continue
Or just, it was, yeah, with the reporter interviewing people on the scene to get their impressions.
Right. Terrible thing. We need to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue to talk about the top local news stories of the week, and we'll speak with Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Welcome back to the local news roundup on The Point. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. Cindy McCormick is here from the Cape Cod Times, and we'll be speaking with several other local journalists throughout the hour. Let's go to one now. Tim Wood is joining us from the Cape Cod Chronicle newsroom in Chatham. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Sean.
Hello. Harwich, going to have a ballot question about this, you know, the topic that is really dominating the news, enforcement of federal immigration laws. We'll be speaking about that topic later on as well. What's going on in Harwich?
So this is a petition measure that was submitted by a resident named Elaine Dickinson. It asked selectmen to protect the civil rights, the civil liberties, and human rights of all Harwich citizens and visitors, regardless of race, religion, national origin, or immigration status. The measure is apparently part of a Cape-wide initiative to put similar articles before town meetings and on ballot questions. And it's also similar to a bill that's before the Mass Senate that largely parallels this initiative. As you said, Sean, it's clearly a reaction to what's going on the national stage. But the measure, if approved, would be largely symbolic, at least down here in Harwich. Police here tell us that they don't proactively enforce any immigration laws. The police chief in Harwich, David Guillemette, said the department lacks jurisdiction to do so. But he did say if a suspect is in custody as a result of a criminal offense and is found to be undocumented, they do have a specific protocol that they go through that involves notifying the Immigration Service. So while the department cooperates with federal agencies, they don't go out of their way to enforce these laws, he said. And he did acknowledge, however, that there's concern that foreign workers who are in town and in the area might be reluctant to contact police to report crimes if they do think that they're going to be deported or get in trouble with immigration for doing so. But he told us, and this was a quote, "We don't ask immigration status. That's just not part of our mission." So the fact that the department reaches out to foreign workers to help with bicycle safety and other safety measures sort of shows that they're not really on that tack. But this measure, if approved in May, it won't make Harwich exactly a sanctuary city, but it will send a message that residents don't want town resources used to enforce these federal immigration laws.
Okay. And as you said, I think that is happening in communities across our region, those types of discussions and perhaps even ballot questions at town meetings. Let's briefly go over and talk about the waterfront upgrades planned for Chatham, some sooner than others. We can't go through all of them, of course, but maybe you could talk about a few of the key ones, Tim.
Sure, just briefly. Chatham, waterways and the waterfront infrastructure in Chatham is very important. We've got the biggest commercial fishing fleet on the Cape. Town officials are proposing $13 million in waterfront upgrades over a five-year period. The most immediate ones are $2.4 million, which will go before voters at town meeting this May, to rebuild and repair the bulkhead at the fish pier, the commercial fish pier here in town. And then there's also some money to begin doing the same thing at the Riders Cove Town Landing, which is also heavily used by bass fishermen in the summer. Now, selectmen are toying with the idea of putting all these projects over a five-year period into a single bond issue to go before voters this year, which would allow them the flexibility to move projects around during that five-year capital period. For instance, they're concerned that the deteriorating conditions in Chatham Harbor due to erosion and South Beach movement and everything might make it not the best thing to do right now to put a lot of money into the fish pier, but maybe to use some of that money to fix up some of the infrastructure the town owns in Stage Harbor. So they want the flexibility to do that, and they're going to be discussing that over the next couple of weeks. Their plan is to make a final decision on how to proceed with that funding at their May 14th meeting.
Okay, Chatham.
March 14th.
March 14th. Okay. Okay, Chatham looking for $13 million in waterfront upgrades. Excuse me. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay. Cindy McCormick is here from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, let's talk about the Nobska Light. It's a lighthouse in Falmouth, and I like to drive by it. And it used to be run by the Coast Guard.
Yes. And then they handed the license to the town. And now the Friends of Nobska Light is the current steward, and they're planning a big refurbishing of this lighthouse. The first step, well, they're going to ask town meeting members in April and Falmouth to set aside about $265,000 $100,000 to for the first stage of the refurbishing for the first stage of the refurbishing process.
Right. So, and that'll actually be for the lighthouse itself, right?
Yes. Yes. There'll be the first stage is the lighthouse itself,
right.
And then the next two stages are that to restore the keeper's cottage as a museum, and then to open an education center by 2020.
Okay. So. Maybe this, I don't remember reading this in the story. Sorry to put you on the spot. Do we know if someone's still going to be living there? It was the commandant from the Coast Guard that was living there, and not anymore, I don't think.
I'm not sure about that, but I do know that there. One of the interesting things about this whole project is that they found out through a historic preservation expert that this lighthouse, it's so iconic, it's beautiful, it's right above the entrance to Woods Hole Harbor. It was originally painted a dark color. It was repainted a red-brown, and it's been white for about the past 100 years, so they're going to keep but white, and this is the because this is the iconic lighthouse that's been featured on multiple postcards and paintings, and
the Falmouth Road Race goes right there.
The helicopters are overhead. If you've ever run the Falmouth Road Race, it's a very exciting moment when you go around that corner and the lighthouse is there.
Mile
and the helicopters
one.
Are.
Yeah. Yeah. NewsHound Dan Treadle just told me that in fact no one will be living there.
No one will be living there. Okay. And if the town meeting okays it, the work will begin immediately this summer.
Okay. Let's go to the phone. Jim Drude is joining us from the New Bedford Standard Times newsroom. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. We were just talking with Tim Wood about a ballot question in Harwich that would restrict local law enforcement from using town resources to enforce federal immigration laws. What's happening in Bristol County? There's a sheriff. The sheriff there seems to be interested in using resources in place for him to enforce federal immigration laws. Is that accurate?
Pretty accurate. He's Sheriff Tom Hodgson in Bristol County has been very active in the immigration field for a long time. In 2006, he built his own ICE detention facility on the property in Dartmouth, and he holds ICE federal detainees there. We have no way to look in and find out how many there are there, how fast they move through, or anything. But the sheriff does boast regularly that brings in $6 million a year from federal reimbursements that. He's just a pass through. It ends up in the Massachusetts General Fund. So he's done. Besides that, he also in January, just about a week before the inauguration of Donald Trump, and it's something we talked about. He started this agreement, signed a memorandum of agreement with ICE, so he can train a couple handfuls of his own correctional officers. They're going to head down to South Carolina, I believe, for 2 weeks of ICE training. Feds will pay for it. The feds are going to put in upgraded computers and things like that in Dartmouth. These guys will be doing their men and women, I assume, will be doing their work at the jail. And when a detainee, when a person comes in and they need to determine whether they're foreign-born or not and whether they're sort of need to be considered for deportation, then these sheriff's correctional officers with ICE training are empowered to detain these people. Then they'll contact, up the chain, an ICE employee who will come down and then begin to start the process of whether that person's going to end up in front of a judge or whether they're not going to go through. And of course, the other thing that the sheriff did when he was sworn in for this latest 6-year term, he announced that he was thinking it'd be a great idea to send inmates out of Massachusetts to help build a wall along the southern border with Mexico, or maybe use them for other federal projects. So what that's done is one of our local legislators, Antonio Cabral, who's a New Bedford Democrat and doesn't really have a record of tangling with the sheriff, but he's got his hands on in two different bills in the legislature. One's still just got a docket number, but the first one wants to restrict to prevent the sheriff from using state money to perform federal jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a very this is like what you're talking about. But logistically, inside his facilities, it would be a very tricky thing. Representative Cabral said that the part of that bill that he believes the sheriff is least happy with is the fact that he would have to really carefully account for what hours people use. Are they on state money or federal money? And he's got to keep track of those records and then go back to the state and say, hey, here's my reimbursement. And the other bill is calculated to prevent him from taking inmates out of Massachusetts unless they've got permission from the Secretary of Public Safety mm-hmm. and the Secretary of Administration and Finance, because it's state funds.
So those are two proposed bills. No idea if they have legs or not in the legislature.
Representative Cabral said that first one about using state money for federal work, he said that there's good taste for that in the state house.
Okay, and Jim, I know you have another story, real brief on this one. Some crime data in for New Bedford and positive, right?
Yeah, all crimes, as they reported it to the FBI, all crimes down 10% in 2016 over 2015. They use a new way of counting that gets much more detail that also covers some things that haven't been counted, like if someone is robbed and assaulted. Under the old reporting system, only the assault would be reported. So to see it go down, and to know that that more crimes are being reported in the reporting system, it is positive for the city's adopting a community policing attitude. They're working like a team and professionally.
Okay. Jim Deruta of the New Bedford Standard Times. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Sean.
And Cindy McCormick is here from the Cape Cod Times, and we'll speak with Cindy in just a moment. But Ed Miller is joining us from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, I understand Provincetown voters will have a say on the site for a new police station in town, a long-talked-about project.
Yes, Sean, that's right. This project has been in the works for years now. The old police station on Shank Painter Road in Provincetown is woefully inadequate. And there's been just this sort of ongoing saga of trying to find the best site. The selectmen, a divided board of selectmen, voted on Monday to send to town meeting voters the question of building the new station on Jerome Smith Way, which is, or Jerome Smith Road, mm-hmm. which is right near Route 6. The problem with that site is that it's actually been designated as a greenway, and so a number of people in town are upset that would turn into a new development, and feel that there are better options. The majority, three members of the selectmen, including Chair Raphael Richter, have decided, as he said, that this is the most optimal site in a series of unoptimal sites. So voters at the April annual town meeting will get to have the final say on it.
And the price tag there, about $8.5 million, a little bit more, right?
Yeah, it's about $8.6 million, according to the estimate of the building committee. And apparently that would be the most economical choice, mainly because it wouldn't involve relocating the police during the construction phase. They could just stay where they are, whereas rebuilding, renovating, or just knocking down and rebuilding the existing police station, which is one option, would cost more. Another wrinkle in the whole thing came up because just in the last few weeks, longtime town doctor, Dr. Brian O'Malley, announced that he was going to be retiring in June, and his building, Provincetown Health Associates building, which is right near the current police station, might potentially become available. But the selectmen aren't willing at this point to count on that because there's no guarantee that the town could actually purchase that building. And they feel like this has been going on so long, it's just time to bite the bullet and build the station over on Jerome Smith Road.
Okay, let's move on to another story. Speaking of acquiring buildings, there was it was a big deal when Provincetown decided to go after this Harbor Hill, condominium complex, and they had to bid on that, right? So now a judge is getting involved, and things are kind of on hold. I don't know if there's even possible to give us the Reader's Digest version on this. It's kind of complex. What's going on?
Well, you're right, Sean. It is a big deal because, of course, there's a critical shortage in Provincetown of year-round rentals, even just for moderate or middle-income people. And this was an opportunity that the town jumped on to buy the 26-unit Harbor Hill condominium over in the West End that went forced into bankruptcy last year. At a special town meeting last month, more than 500 people turned out and approved the borrowing of $10.7 million so that the town could have a chance to successfully bid on this. And in fact, the first stage of the bidding had four sealed bids that were approved to go on to a live auction. The town's bid was the highest of the four, and so people were optimistic about it. The live auction was to take place this past Monday at U.S. Bankruptcy Court in Boston, and everyone in town was eagerly awaiting the outcome of that to see if we were going to get that condominium complex. And what happened, in fact, was that Judge Joan Feeney halted the auction, citing numerous procedural flaws in the sale process, particularly relating to one bid from Lemon Juice Capital, which I think is from an outfit in the Washington, D.C. area. And she wrote in her court order that changes were made in that bid that were neither filed with the court nor served on other interested parties, making it impossible for the court to determine the equivalency of the offer submitted and to conduct an auction with competitive bidding. So she ordered the bankruptcy trustee to come back within 7 days with a new motion, there's not even a date set yet for the live auction to take place. In the meantime, she issued a gag order from the bench forbidding all of the parties from saying anything about the whole thing. So all we know is what's in the court documents. And it's kind of disappointing, but
it's not over yet.
Another saga.
Right, of course. Okay. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean.
We're going to take a quick break. Cindy McCormick is here from the Cape Cod Times. When we get back, Cindy and I are going to talk about sharks. Cindy will talk about it more than I will. And then after that, we expect to speak with Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Welcome back to the local news roundup on The Point here on WCAI. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. With me in the studio is Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times, and we're speaking with several local journalists throughout this hour. Cindy, some numbers coming in, some research numbers regarding the shark population that is visiting the Cape on a regular basis now, and it sounds like there's quite a number of sharks out there.
Yeah, remember when people used to get excited about one great white sighting? Well, researchers during 40 survey trips last year encountered great whites 572 times off the Outer Cape. Hmm. So that's quite a number of encounters. They're going over the video to try to identify the individuals, and scientists have identified at least 279 individual sharks visiting the area. And state shark expert Greg Skomel says, you know, he's seeing a lot of new sharks each year.
And I know that the seashore and communities have put in place different kind of protocol to let people know there are sharks out there when sharks are spotted.
Yeah, this research the information was released during a Monday meeting of a regional shark working group. That's municipal beach managers, town officials, public safety personnel, all the people who are concerned about these sharks getting very close to beaches, which they are. And there are some initiatives out there. There's a shark activity app, which last year there were 40. Well, you can report a shark sighting in real time, and last year there were 46 shark alerts, according to Cynthia Weigren from the she's from the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy. And there is also something called Call One, which would be an automated voicemail alert to everybody on a designated list. That's a new initiative. But for that, you do need a good cell signal, a good signal. And so one of the things is that Orleans spent $30,000 last year to get a strong cell signal at Nauset Beach.
Okay. Well, I think people still get very excited when one shark is sighted. I know the Boston media comes down, and it's kind of a big deal. But, I mean, this is just the new normal now.
Yeah, yeah. It is the new normal. And there were, like I said, there were quite a few sightings off Orleans, or about, let's see, 27 or 28. And then also quite a few off of, 28 sharks detected by receiver. There are these receivers that ring the Cape. And there are 80 sharks that have these acoustic tags that will trigger the receiver. And there are 28 sharks detected off Orleans, right by its large public beach, and 27 sharks were detected from a receiver off Coast Guard Beach in East Ham, but they're all over the place. I mean, they may be concentrated more in these areas, but the sharks are all around the Cape. These receivers are picking them up on Bayside beaches from Sandwich to Provincetown and in Buzzards Bay as well.
Okay. Let's go to Barry Stringfellow on a different topic. Barry is joining us from the Martha's Vineyard Times newsroom. Hello, Barry.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. Let's continue talking about foreign workers and immigration. You did some reporting, the Times did at least, about J-1 and H-2B visa workers, very important to the Cape economy. Maybe you could explain what those visas are and what you're hearing from businesses.
Sure. Well, the J-1 visas are typically a four-month visa, and they have an educational component to it where the foreign workers come over, they work 3 months, and they travel 1 month. The H-2B are seasonal, 6 months at a time. They're mostly in the service industry. They're more strictly for work. And both visa programs have some very concerning issues with them. The J-1s, well, first, President Trump vowed to end the J-1 visa program in one of the presidential debates. He did acknowledge that he uses it, but he said terminating the program would force companies to recruit an American workforce. So far, that hasn't gone too badly. Employers I spoke with, for the most part, have been able to lock in some J-1 employees, although I spoke to one employee a few days ago. She said that her J-1 employee was at the embassy. She had received her visa, but there was a group of about 20 there, and only two got their visas, and she said there was a lot of crying, and she'd never seen anything like that. So there are some changes going on with the J-1, and on a more ominous note, when I spoke to Congressman Keating, he said that there is a draft executive order that could delay all J-1 visas for 90 days to evaluate security procedures. Now, he stressed that it was just a draft, that it hadn't been submitted yet, but they were concerned about it, and he pointed out that the president knows full well how valuable these are because he uses these workers in his business, and according to Department of Labor data, his companies hired at least 190 foreign visa workers since his campaign started in June 2015. The H-2B workers also have reason for concern. And this year, the returning worker exemption was eliminated, which means the quota, which is 66,000 per year, 33,000 for the 2 6-month periods. The returning workers did not used to count against that quota. However, this year they will. And again, Congressman Keating said that it was a partisan vote, and the Democrats supported keeping the exemptions, but all but one of the Republicans opposed it. Department of Labor statistics show that there were about 85,000 H-2 visas last year. So that would have left about 19,000 jobs going begging, which in this part of the country, of course, is a big deal. There's also an issue with the H-2Bs in that you can only apply for these 90 days in advance. And so the Department of Labor said that applications, which started January 2nd, were up over 93% from the previous year, which means these workers get locked in with employers who can start hiring earlier in other parts of the country. Mm. So I spoke to one restaurant manager, and he said he was really concerned about the H-2B situation. They use a lot of H-2Bs. They've been coming for years. And he said the service could really suffer in this part of the country if things aren't straightened out.
That's what it sounds like. Short supply of the workers, and if it's our service industry that could suffer. And I want to mention that this issue that you went through very carefully there, Barry, I know that Mindy Todd is planning to have a discussion about it as well on The Point on Tuesday if listeners want to tune in for that. Barry, Thanks for the reporting. Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times.
You bet.
Okay. Cindy McCormick here from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, on that same kind of issue, there is a woman who has been sentenced in a fraud case related to worker visas, and some of those workers were coming here to the Cape region.
Yeah, that was Mava Dean Thomas, 42, of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. She pleaded guilty in June to one count of conspiracy to commit visa fraud and one count of encouraging and inducing illegal immigration for private financial gain. She was sentenced on Tuesday to 3 years probation and the first year to be served as home probation. She also has to forfeit $37,000 and pay a fine of $4,000.
So how was that working? What was she doing?
Well, according to acting U.S. Attorney William Weinreb, she secured H-2B visas for foreign workers through fraud, but thereby she created a permanent labor pool of unauthorized immigrants who took jobs that should have gone to American citizens or authorized immigrants. And the federal officials say that she submitted fraudulent visa petitions on behalf of several Cape businesses, and including the International Inn and Suites in Hyannis, the Lobster Pound in Orleans, and the Lobster Shanty in East Ham. She also prepared visa applications for businesses listed in South Carolina and West Yarmouth that don't actually exist. And
So these businesses didn't necessarily know.
Yes. Yeah. The federal officials say the businesses were often unaware that she had applied for these H-2B visas on their behalf. And the owner of the International Inn told investigators he had never applied for the work visas.
Wow. I'm sure we'll be seeing more of these cases as feds continue to clamp down on these issues. Let's talk about Entergy. Entergy, of course, owns the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, and which is, I guess, how should we say it? Because we don't know if it's really going to close in 2019, but the owner says they plan to close in 2019. And the story this week is another step in that process. Of course, there's a lot of skepticism about whether it will close.
Right. Well, Entergy Corporation is requesting that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission approve a certified fuel handler training program. Now, certified fuel handlers are needed to replace plant operators after a reactor stops producing power. And that's when the focus moves to moving the radioactive fuel assemblies, and there are 3,000 at Pilgrim, from this sprawling spent fuel pool in the reactor building to these mammoth concrete and dry and steel dry casks for long-term storage.
Right. And so basically now they're in a pool, they're cooling off this spent fuel, and once the plant is closed down, and they've already begun some of this process, put that spent fuel in these casks where they're supposedly safer.
Right, and until further action is taken. But Entergy is asking that the NRC approve this plan to train these fuel handlers by December 15th because they say, you know, they need time. They don't want to wait until, you know, it's closed and June, mid-June of 2019, you know, just a few months before that to start training. So, and they, But Entergy has changed its mind in the past on this type of issue. It gave a similar notice in 2015 that it would shut down nuclear power plant in New York called the Fitzpatrick plant, and they said they're going to shut it down by early 2017, and they submitted a request for a certified fuel handler training program for Fitzpatrick that is identical to the Pilgrim request. But in September, a company called Exelon Corporation announced it would purchase Fitzpatrick from Entergy for $110 million and keep it running.
So that's the concern. That's why people around here who are opposed to the plant's continued operation are worried a similar thing could happen, that in the last minute they could sell it to another company that would then continue to operate it.
Right, because now Fitzpatrick's license doesn't expire until late 2034, and Pilgrim's license goes until 2032. So concerned neighbors of Pilgrim, that's a group that's worried there's a real possibility that Pilgrim will continue to operate past June 1st, 2019. Of course, not everybody wants it shut down. Someone to preserve jobs there, and others like the $9 million annual payments to Plymouth.
Right. And some people are concerned about the power supply.
Right.
So there's it's very complex. Let's move on to another story. The Mashpee Wampanoag tribe is taking action against the opioid addiction issue, which is tearing through New England as a whole. The tribe has lost quite a number of tribe members to this scourge. They had a meeting. What's happening?
Yeah, more than 100 people showed up for a meeting on Tuesday with, and that included people from the police department, both the Mashpee and Wampanoag Tribal Police Department, as well as experts from the Indian Health Service. And they, as a recognized federal tribe, the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe benefits from the Indian Health Service. And Dr. Mike, a physician from the IHS, said that one of the important things is to emphasize the use of opioids for chronic pain. He said it should only be used as a last resort, never as a sole therapy. Also, the IHS requires all prescribers to be trained on prescribing opiates. That was an initiative they undertook last year. And they also check with the state prescription monitoring bases so they can keep track and see if there are patients who are going from doctor to doctor for these drugs.
Right. Well, it is good that the tribe has access to that Indian Health Service and that they're coordinating efforts, since it sounds like a lot of tribe members actually use that service.
And also Martha Ketcher, she's from Nashville area, director of the IHS, said that the IHS is committed to funding a case manager to help Mashpee Wampanoag members with addictions coordinate patient care. So that would be a really important step, because that can be a very harrowing process to go through, just trying to line up the care that you need.
Right, of course. That's the story we keep hearing over and over again, how hard it is to get into treatment. Spraying underneath power lines by the utility has been controversial on Cape Cod for quite some time. Rather than going in and hand cutting things down, they use herbicides, backpacks, go in and select kind of specific spraying. But it's controversial because we have a sole source aquifer here on Cape Cod, basically a pool of water sitting below us where we get
our drinking water. There's concern that these chemicals, if they remain in the soil, could actually seep into the aquifer.
Right.
And now currently Eversource Energy is planning to have this herbicide spraying for 13 towns on Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard. And that will be, as you said, under the electric transmission lines to control weeds and tall plants. And they submitted this to the Massachusetts Department of Agricultural Resources for approval. And deadline on comments on the Eversource plan is March 27th, although the herbicides will not be applied till after Labor Day. But people just have until March 27th to submit their comments.
And we have seen the utility, NSTAR in the past, or Eversource now, say, okay, we'll take a hiatus on this.
Yeah, there was no spraying in 2000 and last year in Brewster, Orleans, and Dennis, even though they were on the spray list. Now, Brewster, Orleans, and Dennis, along with Eastham, were part of a plan to try to overturn this Department of Agriculture's approval of the 2016 spray plan. They each pitched in $15,000 for this legal effort. A hearing that they are pursuing was never heard, but the fact that those three towns did not get sprayed last summer, they think that may have had an impact. Hmm. And they're continuing with this whole legal process of trying to get a hearing with the Department of Agriculture.
We've hit on many of the major issues that the Cape and Islands and the South Coast kind of face during this hour here. You know, the Pilgrim is a big one, of course. Immigration issues, as well as workforce housing and such. Now let's talk about ticks, because that's another one.
Yeah, the sharks are big and scary, but ticks are tiny and they're probably, have impacted a lot more people on Cape Cod. Unfortunately, made a lot of people ill and actually have caused a few deaths actually on Cape Cod through babesiosis. And so what Cape Codders can do, and they've been able to do this for the past couple years, but if you find a tick on you or your dog and you're concerned that it may contain some disease pathogen, you can send it to the University of Massachusetts lab, the lab of Steve Rich. Now, thanks to a $30,000 grant from Cape Cod Healthcare, a subsidy for Cape Codders is continuing through next year. And the cost for the lab report would be about $50 for members of the public, and it would cost more also to have this RNA test for this new Powassan virus that can be deadly. But for Cape Codders, the cost for the standard test and the Powassan virus is just $15, thanks to the continued subsidy from Cape Cod Healthcare.
Okay, so if I find a tick on my son, I remove it, I'm worried about a pathogen, I can send it to UMass, and it'll be significantly less to have that looked at and tested.
It'll be $15 $10. Well, once you go on their site, they're at www.tickreport.com. You type in your address and your zip code, then the price will go down to the $15. So we'll recognize that. Mm-hmm. And you get the results within 3 business days now. They're
it's a real
fast.
Peace of mind, of course, with Lyme disease. The concern is that you could have it, not know it. Mm-hmm. At least if you had the tick tested, you would know that. So hold on to your ticks. We've got to say goodbye. Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times, thanks for coming into the Woods Hole studio.
Thank you.
And thanks to Sam Houghton from the Mashpee Enterprise, Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim DeRuta of the New Bedford Standard Times, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, and we spoke with Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times as well. I'm Sean Corcoran from WCAI. Thank you for listening.